Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Where are we?
I've lost it.
We're in Denver.
It is getting a bit like that. Well, at least you're in your room. I'm downstairs in the boardroom because I have no internet in my room. There's some sales conference going on outside.
Yeah. No, it's tricky. We are in Denver, but we seem to be bouncing around a lot at the moment. We played this little sort of game the other night when we were naming cities that we'd been to and trying to remember what the hotel looked like. And most people couldn't.
Gig.
Yeah, all the gig.
Yeah, it all gets mixed up. The thing is, because we move so fast, this tour moves so fast, it's impossible to get a fix on anything. I mean, I was just remembering, like, New York was 5 days ago.
Yeah, but it seems like an eternity. I mean,
there's been four cities since then. It's insane.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with touring is, and I think the most stressful thing is the change. It's every time you enter a new hotel room, it's getting used to that space, trying to claim that space. Do you know a dog woke me up in the middle of the night outside my room, crying outside my room? It was so freaky. It turns out it's a dog-friendly hotel and the woman across the hall has got a dog. And must have let it out for some reason. but the only constant is the stage that we walk onto, which is always exactly the same mapping, and the bus, of course.
Well, it's also the thing is because it's just checking out of your room, which you do every day, is traumatic. It's traumatic. You always think you've left something. You always, you know.
Yeah.
So you have that trauma every day. I'm sure there's people with kind of proper jobs and everything who are just going,
Yeah.
I mean, There's only so much sympathy you can ask for, isn't there? Really?
Our coal face isn't too hard, is it, really?
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Anyway, Daryl Jones, a bass player.
Daryl Jones. Extraordinaire.
I'm just going to sit back and watch the fireworks between two amazing bass players, I guess.
Well, I don't know. No, he's a proper grown-up, can run with scissors and everything. I mean, this is, because his career path is extraordinary because he's got this film out, which we watched, and there seems to be... Like, for most of us, my career followed this quite sort of, if you look at it in the past, it was this quite steady upward curve, sort of culminating in Pink Floyd. And once you're there, all the stuff that comes around that, you're already there. But it was a steady curve. Whereas him, there's like a chapter missing.
Yeah, straight to Miles Davis.
Do you know what I mean? Straight to Miles Davis, right? And so I'm very intrigued to get into that.
I know.
And
so
he plays for the Rolling Stones.
He's played for the Rolling Stones for nearly 30 years. I mean, he's still not considered part of the band. He's probably still on the payroll, but we all know Daryl from his work with the Stones. And also, you know, he played on probably the best Sting album, The Dream of Blue Turtles, and Madonna. He's toured with.
We've got so much in common.
So much in common. Is he five string or four string? He's four string, isn't he?
He's four string. He goes five. But I mean, you know, he's a jazzer. He's jazz. Jazzers. I mean, jazzers don't go five. They go straight to sort of 12.
He's on this show to talk rock. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
So great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. To
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Oh, he's on, he's muted, he's on, he's muted. We can't see him, can't hear him. He's there, oh, he's on, he's off.
Video.
Yay!
Yay!
Daryl.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah,
I can
see.
Great.
And hear you. Wow, that looks nice. Are you in France, Daryl?
No. I'm in Los Angeles.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, you're just no, on the
I
road.
Was,
oh.
I was in France a couple of days ago.
Ah.
Yeah.
Hello, we're in Denver. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, man, real pleasure. Real pleasure.
We're in Denver.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. Cool.
We're on the road. We play with Nick Mason from the Floyd.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes,
man.
We're doing that.
And you're doing podcasts from the road. You guys are.
Yeah, I tell you, we're at it.
Responsible musicians. Who would have thought?
Exactly what we are, Darryl.
Oh, wow.
We're talking of responsible musicians because you and I met backstage in Paris. We're introduced by my dear friend Chuck Lavelle.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you were telling me about a bass you designed.
Yeah, man. I've got stuff all around here, man. all of this stuff. This is a guitar.
What was the one you designed, though?
The one I designed is this one. It's, you know, it's a Fender, you know, more than anything, it's a Fender type instrument, but it's got a little booty.
Curves.
You know?
Nice. Yeah. Oh, it has. It's got a bum.
You know, bass got to have some bottom, right? You know?
I can't believe it's taken this long and you to come up with that.
Well, you know, it's one of those things, you know.
Because you guys both have Chuck Lavelle in common, don't you? Because Chuck plays with David Gilmour, you play with David Gilmour, plays with the Stones, with the Stones. Right. So Chuck's the kind of common ground here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great keyboard
player. Man, I just watched his documentary. It's incredible, man. Really incredible.
He's done one.
Yeah, he's got a documentary that's really beautiful. I think it's The Tree Man. But anyway, Chuck Lavelle, it's incredible. He's such a...
He used to do things when we're on tour, right? The thing is, he'd do things like... He in the bar after the gig, rather than, oh, this is like some lawyer I met or some musician, it would be like, this is the EU Minister for Forestry. And then he went off one day and he sent me some pictures, said, hey, guy, I just did this thing. What do you think? And he went and he gave a concert at the Steel Chainsaw Factory.
Right, okay, yeah.
And he's on a podium, right, at a grand piano, surrounded by all these people, and just thousands of chainsaws. And I was just thinking, if you just looked at that picture with no idea of the context, you'd go, what the fuck is going on here?
Hang on, I'm quite confused, because I was thinking like the tree man, then he's into loving and hugging trees. I mean, you can't get more anti-tree than a chainsaw.
No, he has two massive sort of reservations. He's a great tree conservationist.
Yeah, he's a tree conservationist. So he grows trees, and he's one of
he's got two plantations down in, you know.
Yeah, no, he's back, got, yeah, no.
I can't remember where they are.
Quite a
arboretum.
Yeah, quite a.
No. Bigger than that.
Yeah, no. He's got quite a thing. I mean, and the former president Jimmy Carter is in the
documentary. That's right.
You know, so he's doing some great things, man. And and just killer musician as you.
So we watched your documentary In the Blood. It's great. How did it all come about? Who directed it?
This guy, Eric Hamburg, who was involved with Oliver Stone in the Nixon film, because Eric Hamburg, he's out of politics. He was assistant to, one of the guys who ran for president a few years back. I'll think of his name.
Democrat, I hope.
Yes.
shouldn't give away my political leanings. But
Darryl's from Chicago. We know who comes from Chicago.
Yeah, right. Exactly. my political affiliations are probably pretty clear, considering where I'm from. You know,
I think we're on the same page here, mate.
Yeah, but he's a real big Stones fan. The director Eric, and he, I guess, had been through them watching when I came on and had been watching my career and just said, hey, man, I think we should do a documentary about you. And I was like, I haven't done enough yet. I mean, I was like, it's the Chicago second city kind of syndrome where you just never feel like you've done enough, you know?
But
he's got incredible bona fide. So I said, how do you say no to that? Such a thing, so.
And how long did he follow you around for?
Oh man, it took us 8 years to finish. Actually, we did the first interviews almost 8 years ago, I think.
Because the saddest thing about the documentary is obviously, this was before Charlie had died, and seeing Charlie beautifully talking about you and seeing him looking so well as talking on the documentary.
Yeah.
It's been tough. That
yeah, no, that's been a tough part of, you know, the last few years, man. It was exciting to get back to, you know, to touring after, you know, the COVID years, but it was really sad that, you know, that he wasn't along with us.
But because you must have had that, you know, that whole that jazz connection, which is because that was, as you know, people said, that's why the Stones always swung like they do, you know.
Yeah, no, man, he was just such an extraordinary musician and person, you know. Just I just watched a video of him being interviewed, I guess about the time, it must have been right before I joined the band, but yeah, so he looks so elegant and so handsome, man. He's, you know, that's one that that hadn't occurred to me until a couple of nights ago. Not only was he an incredibly, you know, beautiful dresser, but he's also a really handsome guy.
But it's true, isn't it, what you say, Guy, you know? And in a way, Charlie's got quite a lot in common with Nick Mason as well, mm-hmm. that sort of slightly jazz mm-hmm. influence,
yeah,
playing.
Yeah, that loping in and out of yeah. three, four, mm-hmm. kind of, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's an English thing, I think, in a way.
Mm. Apparently you have shoes in common as well.
Yeah, man, he took me to his shoemaker, George Cleverly, in London. And
okay, let me make a note of that. Is that German Street or somewhere?
It's in that little archway. It's in that little
Burlington.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Burlington Arcade.
Burlington
yeah.
Arcade.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
We're not sponsored by
yeah.
them.
Go and see George Glass.
Yet.
He'll take care of you. Yeah.
And how was it really? You know, the shift to now you're playing with Steve Jordan in the band, and because in a way it's bittersweet, isn't it? You know, you're excited that you can still go out, but
yeah.
to not have Charlie there has been a very difficult situation. How are you fitting in with Steve?
Well, I, you know, Steve and I go way back. As a matter of fact, you know, Steve Jordan and Charlie Drayton are the guys kind of who were my entree onto the rock and roll scene. You know, I heard what they were doing with Keith Richards on the Talk Is Cheap record and thought, oh, wait a minute. Because I had been doing kind of the electric jazz thing, Miles and Herbie Hancock's and Steps Ahead and that stuff. And I'd done Sting, but I hadn't really done, you know, too much more of the, you know, the rock side. And so, but playing with Steve, man. So, you know, he and I go, as I was saying, he and I go back. It's, you know, it's the next best thing, I have to say. Absolutely the next best thing to playing with Charlie, because he's such a student of this music, you know. And, you know, it's almost like seeing the world from, you know, someone fresh's eyes. You know, we've taken, you know, we've looked back on some of the recordings, we've looked back on some of the live things before I was in the band, since I've been in the band, and so we're having a little a fresh look at the music, and I definitely, you know, I commend him on, you know, he's just trying to get it right, man. He's really trying to get it. So it's exciting. It's really exciting. And he's an incredible musician. And got a great feel, and
because your whole growing up, man, in Chicago, and of course the very fact that you're Chicago, which of course is Mecca for the Stones.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Because
yeah,
for the
yeah.
Stones, all roads lead to Chicago,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
and yet you are a part of this. You know, from the documentary, all the music you grew up around, which is brilliant, which is literally everything that was on offer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I get the feeling, you know, your family had a lot to do with that, right?
Yeah, no, I was really, you know. Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's actually very much reflected in the music you're making with your band.
Yeah, absolutely.
His dad, your dad was a drummer, right?
Yeah, yeah. He didn't play a lot professionally, but just was always practicing in the house and taught me basically how to...
God, how annoying.
Yeah, right. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, what you grew up listening to from the time you're a child, you know, it's comforting in a way. You know, you come in the house, you know, shopping with mom, you know, Saturday evening, and da 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 da, you know, it's like, oh great, dad's in the basement, you know, doing his thing, you know.
You have a great quote in the film where you say, the music I play is my childhood.
Yeah, no, I mean, because think about, you know, in the 60s, I was born in 61, so the music of the, you know, the 60s and early 70s, man, it's a gold mine. And, you know, and then music wasn't quite as segregated then as it is now. I mean, because, you know, the Stones were on black radio, Elton John was on black radio, mm-hmm. you know, oh, wow. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, all the, you know, Angie was probably, to be honest with you, you know, Angie was probably the first big song that I was, I mean, Satisfaction, you know, but I was, you know, 4 years old when came out. So, but yeah, the Beatles, James Brown, and there was still blues stuff on, you know, some blues stuff on the radio at that time. So, it, you know, plus in the music scene in Chicago as well was also very fertile because you were doing, you know, church gigs, you were doing nightclubs, you were doing, you know, bar mitzvahs, you're doing all this different kind of stuff and playing all these different kinds of music. So it was a really fertile, you know, kind of learning ground.
Because you had music at your school from a very early age, didn't
incredible
you?
Music
this
program
is amazing.
At my school. Yeah, incredible yeah. music program. I mean, like, anything that you wanted to get into, you were, you know, there was an orchestra and you were the director was like, Daryl, you should write some charts for the orchestra. You know, it's like, what? You know, but the opportunities were there, you know, to play a lot of different kinds of music and to write music and to, you know, just to understand more about music and to spend all day from, you know, from really from my sophomore year, there were five, six, seven periods of music. So
why is that? Because it was a state school, wasn't it? It was, as you say, a public school.
It was a public school, but it was just known for this music department. It was also known for football. There's some really great, you know, American football players that came out, basketball players that came out. It was such a big school. I think the my freshman class was 1,200 students.
Right.
And so the whole school was about 4,500 students. So it was a huge school and great band, great orchestra, great vocal department. And so it was a vocational school. So if your vocation was music, then you really learned music in that way, as if you were learning, you know, car mechanics or whatever.
Now, Guy always talks about the reason he's the bass player is, like, he thinks a lot, this is true of all bass players, is there was already a guitar player in the band. That's what you say, isn't it?
That, you know, that wasn't the case for me. I was a bass player from the very beginning, though I did start
I was, but only because my parents wouldn't get me an electric guitar.
Oh, really? I don't know if you remember in the movie, I talk about, I didn't really know the difference. I knew that there was a bass.
That's right. You had a guitar, but that must have been amazing because you were learning on a six string, but just playing four strings.
Right.
That gives you such an edge. That's like, you know, how the Brazilian football team practice with a smaller ball.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So that's the same thing. Yeah. That's the same thing.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But what made the bass fall into your hands then?
It was the guy, you know, I saw this talent show. I saw the guy who I knew playing. I decided I'm going to ask him to teach me to play the guitar. And when I walked up to him and said, hey, man, I want you to teach me to play the guitar. He said, I don't play the guitar. Well, he says, you know, you want to play lead guitar or you want to play bass guitar? And I said, well, what do you play? And he said, I play bass guitar. And I said, well, then I want to learn how to play bass guitar. And that was basically when I found out there was a guitar that had four strings. I didn't know that. I thought all guitars had six strings. And I thought the bass was this thing that from my dad's records, from Miles Davis records and, you know, Count Basie and all of that stuff. I didn't know there was an electric bass guitar. I didn't know that instrument really existed. I mean, I was 9 years old, so, you know. So, no, that's how
what's
I got
funny? Do you know what's funny, though, is that when the electric bass guitar first came along, it was jazzers who adopted it first. Rock and roll still played stand-up.
That's right. That's true.
It's actually Lionel Hampton's bass player was the first.
Right, exactly. That's right. Monk Montgomery was one of the first guys.
Who was Lionel Hampton? Is it the guy? Tell me.
Vibe player who, you know, who was, you know, around, or he was around in the 40s, I guess, and was still touring when I started with Miles in the 80s. So he had a long, long and storied career.
When I was touring with Miles, I love that just sits there.
I know.
Come on.
I know, Miles Davis. I mean,
that is literally the pinnacle by which everything is measured.
We're going to get to Miles. But you obviously took up the bass at the same time that the bass started becoming the lead instrument in funk music, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was. I call it the second, you know, bass renaissance, or, you know, the because, you know, Jamerson, you know, in the 60s,
Jamerson.
And then in the 80s, yeah, with cats like, you know, Bootsy and Larry Graham, all those guys, and, you know,
because I would always say, because jazz was kind of where a lot of the, especially from things like Kind of Blue, where sort of modern bass playing as we know it kind of comes from. Because I would say, Daryl, I don't know if you'd agree, that actually it was left to Jameson, and I would say McCartney, to actually write the book on what kind of pop bass playing was.
I agree with you.
Good. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but would you say that same thing to a certain extent? Because we were saying yesterday, Guy, how... Because there's this strange interview in your documentary, Daryl, where it's Mick, obviously in the 80s and late 80s, and he's saying, well, it's not very hard to play bass in the Rolling Stones, right. You know, and I think he was probably a bit upset that Bill Wyman had just left. But Bill set a certain benchmark.
Bill was a brilliant bass player. There were brilliant lines.
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, man, because whenever we play, wherever we're at, if we're in touring Europe, whenever you go into stores, when the Stones are in town, there's Stones on the radio. So you're hearing all of these songs. And I remember hearing Start Me Up and going, wow, we don't play that the way that they played it back then. And Bill is so funky on that. The same thing is
true. Oh, yeah. His spacing.
Oh, man. And the same thing is true for what he plays on Miss You. The way he messes around, it's one of the great disco lines. Yeah, the way he messes around with the downbeat, upbeat, boom, doom, ding, doom, ding, doom, 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 eat, oot, the way he messes around with that is brilliant. It really is brilliant, you know. So I would say I would have to add him and a bunch of the guys who we heard, because really when you think about it, the guys who were on the radio in those years in the 60s, in the 60s and 70s, all of those guys taught us how to play the bass.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to get too muso, because I would say another just on Bill, that actually what makes the riff of Satisfaction work is the harmony he's playing on the bass.
Mm-hmm, that's true, yeah. Because it's not what you think it is.
No, it's not what you think it is.
You hear the song, you think, oh, everybody's doing that thing. He's playing something else.
He's playing something else, exactly.
Mm-hmm. But it was Stanley Clarke, wasn't it, that really turned you on, though, Daryl?
Yeah, he was definitely.
I remember buying some of those records when I was a kid, and I was getting into what was called jazz funk or jazz. Well, jazz
fusion.
Funk,
it was fusion. Oh no,
I never said the word fusion when I was a teenager.
Yeah, jazz rock.
And he was all I kind of pretended I liked him, but he was so difficult. It was like musical maths at times, wasn't it?
A friend of mine lent me that record, the one with the Stanley Clarke record with him holding the bass. And I ruined that record learning that stuff, because basically what I did was I took the 30, I took the album and put it on 16, and it's a little bit out of tune. So I retuned the bass so that I could learn those lines at half speed, So I agree with you. It was very difficult.
It was, well, that was when I just started playing the bass, and everything was about Stanley Clarke. Everything was about, and I was just thinking, really? Is that what I have to do? Because I can't. Maybe I should play something else.
it was daunting. And then Jaco came along, and it just seemed like another layer,
So what bands did you form then as a kid, and what kind of music were you playing locally?
Well, a lot of funk stuff.
Because you ended up playing with Clay.
Huh? Otis Clay.
You ended up playing Otis Clay.
Yeah, I played with Otis Clay. And so that was like my soul thing. That was a period where I was playing a lot of soul. And to be honest, I didn't play a lot of blues in Chicago. There were only one or two blues acts that I played with. It was soul, and with him more than anyone else, that I really started playing that music. And so we played a lot of blues clubs, but it was soul music. He's very much.
If you're a kid, man, it's like if you look at funk, soul, blues, it's clear what's sexier.
Yeah,
as a bass player, really.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. Yeah. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. No. The funk.
Was that your breakthrough as far as your parents were concerned? Was it now Daryl's got a job, and he's making some money, he's going to be a professional musician, or did they want you to be something else?
No. I had all the support of my parents. They let the bands that I played with all through grammar school and high school rehearse in the basement, that's a real commitment. That lets you know your parents really are behind you if they let the band rehearse in your basement for years and years, So, no, I had complete support of my parents. And
already got your dad practicing everywhere all the
time. You're right, exactly. And my mom loved music. As I said in the movie, she took us to see James Brown. Any place you could take a child to see James Brown between maybe 68 and 73 or 74, she took us, you know. And so
she was a bit cross with you at one of the auditions, wasn't she?
Yeah, actually, yeah. It was the rehearsal for the Otis Clay gig, the first rehearsal, when I hadn't learned the material. And she was, because the dynamic in our household was either you're in school or you work. And I wasn't in school, you know, I was, you know, in between, you know, college classes or whatever like that, and, you know, living in the house. And she was like, hey, you got to work. If your work is knowing music and, you know, is playing music, then you got to know what you're doing. You can't be slacking. You know, your father doesn't slack. So you got to be, you know, you gotta deal with what you're dealing with.
Why didn't you know the material, Daryl? Were you not interested?
Know, or again, we go back to this, like, you know, it wasn't like Stanley Clarke. It wasn't hard, you know. It's like, oh, that's like soul. I can handle that. And so, you realize, wow, you know, there is something to that. You do have to, any kind of music, you have to spend some time dealing. Yeah. That's one of the other, you know, major things that I talk about, particularly to students. You can't be looking down your nose at anything and consider yourself playing it authentically. You got to give it some time. You got to give it time. You got to give it respect and some love in order to be able to.
Simple and slow can be the absolute hardest.
What did your mother say to you when you got back in the car? I can't believe she sat there watching.
Just what I said. She said, listen, you call yourself this musician. If you're a musician, you don't show up at work unprepared. You know, it's like, what are you doing?
I know. These are the nightmares that I always have. I mean, all musicians have those, you know. I think my most recent one was I was asked to go on stage and play guitar with Queen.
Ooh.
And I took it so for granted. And I walked on. I hadn't rehearsed a single note. I didn't know where I was.
Yeah. And then you end up not enjoying what you should be really, really enjoying.
That's right.
You're like,
because you're just hanging on. Yeah, you're just hanging on.
You know.
But I guess also the thing is, we're playing with someone like Otis Clay and playing soul, is you're starting now to learn that the bass doesn't always have to be playing, you know, thousands of notes.
Exactly.
That you had, you know, every bass player just can lay down that groove, get in the pocket, and offer something that still contains your personality.
Exactly.
Were you beginning to find who you were?
Yes, I was. By that time, because I was, that was not long before the Miles thing happened. I was probably 19, 20 years old when that happened. And I had kind of been through, I guess, the college, you know, I was away at college in 1979, 80. I think it was at that point that I realized I'm not going to really make a living playing like Stanley Clarke or Jaco Pastorius. I've got to figure out how I play. And also, you just, you know, start to be a little bit more mature about, you know, what the function of the bass and even in jazz music, that you got to have some solidity. You got to make the musicians around you feel like you're supporting them. And like you said, and bring your own personality and not somebody else's who you've been. I mean, I think it's invaluable to copy musicians, you know, as you're developing. But eventually you got to get out and figure out what it is that's inside you. And that's how you play, you know, authentically. I think you have to, you know, play.
Do you know, I had a thing, Daryl, when I was learning, where I was so worried that I thought that if I just learned other people's bass lines, then I wouldn't have my own style.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't learn any songs,
which
is just the stupidest thing in the world. So I actually have no idea how I learned.
it's really an interesting thing, because I'm doing the same thing on guitar. I love the guitar. I'm even building guitars, even though I'm a bass player. But I don't know songs on the guitar. So, you know, a couple of times I've been on stage playing guitar, I've been exposed, because that's how you teach yourself how to play an instrument.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just to move along, I don't know if we're moving too fast, but I'm sorry, but I'm just so excited to get to Miles. Because there seems to be like a chapter missing, Daryl. It's like you're going along and you've got all these gigs in Chicago and you're getting really nicely well-rounded with selling stuff, and then it's Miles.
Yeah.
Were you still living at home?
I was still living at home, yeah. The call came.
Tell us the story of the audition. Come on.
I literally the phone rings. I pick it up. It's Miles's nephew, who's a good friend of mine. We're playing around town, and he had been in Japan with Miles, kind of as Miles's assistant. And they come back, and Miles is, ready to change the bass chair. And he says, "Miles wants to hear you play over the phone." So I you've heard the whole story that happens in the movie, but I go to New York.
Tell us.
Yeah, well, I go out looking for my bass. I'm not even practicing bass. I'm practicing the Chapman stick. I can't find my bass. I go back to the phone. Hold on. I realize it's in the back of my mom's car. And then Vince says, "No, you hold on." And then I hear Miles's voice. And he says, "When can you be in New York?" And I'm just trying not to be too eager, And I said, it was a Monday. I said, I could be there Wednesday. And he said, "What's going to take you so long? You going to walk?" And so I said, "Oh,
you gotta
no,
do
no,
that
no.
voice. You got to do the voice.
Oh, yeah.
What's going to take you so long? You go walk."
Exactly.
Now. Because I love the story. Because, the Herbie Hancock story of his audition.
Oh, right. Very, very.
The phone rang. And he went, "Hello?" This voice just went, "My place, 1 o'clock tomorrow."
Oh, yeah.
And put the phone down. Yeah. Didn't say who it was, where it was, or anything. But it's like, it's Miles.
So what happened when you got to New York?
Got to New York, met him at this apartment. I go upstairs. He said, before I play a note, he says, "Listen, if this doesn't work out, it's not that, you can't play. It's that I'm looking for something else." Which is really incredibly sweet when you think about what people think about Miles being this really hard, mean guy. He wasn't at all. He was really a sweet guy, and he was taking care of me before I played a note. So I played a slow B-flat blues. He stopped me a couple of times. I mean, real slow. And I played it for a while, and then he stopped me, and he said, "Play along with this tape." And I played along with the tape for a little while.
What was the tape?
It was a board tape of some gigs that they had done in Japan, like recent gigs that they'd done. And I guess he was just trying to figure out if I could improvise bass lines for these, for these kind of open jams that they were doing. So a lot of the music at that time was a little bit more open, kind of funk jams.
And Witch's Brew had already come out, right?
Bitches Brew.
Bitches Brew.
This is the 80s, yes.
So
he'd established this kind of funk, jazz, electric thing. That you were fitting in with.
Right, exactly. And so when I think about you're speaking about a kind of gap. Well, I grew up playing funk grooves from James Brown. I grew up playing a little bit of jazz around town and Sly Stone and Jimi Hendrix and all of these things that really did kind of prepare me for this moment. In addition to that, the guys who I grew up playing with who were slightly older, they loved Bitches Brew. So when we jammed, we would try to jam like Miles Davis, playing Bitches Brew. So when, I remember the first night I played with him, he sent somebody to come and get me, and I go in his dressing room and he says, "Do you have any questions?" And I go, "No." And he kind of laughs like, "Okay, you're just coming on. You never played with anybody, with this, you haven't played in this arena yet." So, but I had really been prepared by the musicians that I was playing with.
But what about the size of the venues and stuff? Was that?
I guess I played around enough where that didn't really, didn't really affect me. I don't know. I've always been more comfortable on stage than even, you're in the club and, I'm 16 years old. I'm on stage and I'm playing and I know what I'm doing. I got to put the bass down and walk into the club. That's when I'm uncomfortable.
No, I agree. I've always said it's like, it's 50,000 people you don't know is so much easier than 50 people you do.
Exactly. Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah.
There's some great archive in the film of you and Miles on stage together. And what's so beautiful is you're a handsome young boy, and he's right up against you with his blowing downwards with his trumpet.
Yeah.
And you're just like staring at him, trying to weave with him, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
That's quite magical. Just explain what was going on between you and Miles.
No, man. So it was the strangest thing. He would stand so close to me sometimes, and I'm there and I'm playing, and sometimes it just occurred to me, like, it's fucking Miles Davis, you know. And you know, we would be, you know, he'd be doing stuff like da-da-da-da-da, and I'd be pat, and almost like we were like sparring a little bit, you know. And or sometimes he would talk. He would, "So touch, I didn't go to bed last night." You know what I mean? You know, I'd be like, "Miles, we could put, no, one more song. No, two more. No, three more." You know, he was, and people would always ask me, "What were you guys talking about?" And I'm like, "You wouldn't believe if I tell you, I have to kill you." You know?
And I gather they're not set arrangements either.
Well, I was going to say, this is the thing with Miles. Okay, it's not like some legendary artist where you've got to go and learn the catalogue or whatever, because Miles just plays where he's at.
Right.
Am I right?
There were some loose arrangements, and they were generally, depending on, you know, a line that he would play that would lead us to this place, or there's something somebody would play that would lead us to the next section. There were a few songs where we played, you know, just the song, you know, particularly a little bit later, you know, after I'd been in the band for a while. But yes, some of them were just kind of open jams, and you'd like hope that you found a bass line that worked with all these deep, the keyboard player and guitar players were playing. I mean, it was pretty magical, man, you know.
And you recorded with him as well. You did Decoy.
Yeah, Decoy and You're Under Arrest, those two records I did with him. And there's a bunch of bootleg stuff and some stuff from live gigs. There's some stuff from Montreux. There's some stuff from the Jazz Festival in Montreal.
And what happened? How come you left?
Well, I left the first time. I had recorded with Sting, the Dream of the Blue Turtles record.
His best album, mate.
Yeah, Sting's album, first album after he left the Police. And
no, it's best, I said.
Oh, really? Well,
No question.
Oh, man, but, you know, some of that Police.
Amazing songs. You
know, yeah, really great stuff. It just looked to be like something that I didn't want to miss, you know, what was coming after we recorded that record, a world tour. They were just talking about doing a documentary. And I guess I just didn't want to miss it. And I thought it was maybe a chance to widen my horizons a little bit. And so I went to Miles and told him, man, I really want to do this thing with him, but I want to come back. And like I say in the movie, he told me, he says, I don't know if that we'll be able to do that, but he gave me his blessing finally. And
finally.
That's
a real testament, though, that you did come back. But here's the Sting thing. This is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. In that Sting was someone who started, he used to play in big bands and stuff up in Newcastle and everything. And he came, you know, he's this incredibly gifted songwriter and comes up through the whole kind of new wave thing. And the pop world becomes this giant pop star. And then once he gets to that platform, he uses that success and that reach to complete the opposite of most people, to get what you guys have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, to kind of embrace this world of jazz, which was incredibly risky for someone.
Which is, oh, no, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Police were the biggest band in the world in, 1982? You know, he had a certain amount of influence and cachet and stature in the business. It was edgy, though. I mean, for him to choose to use these elements from this, you know, kind of, electric jazz thing, and to put it with what he was doing, which is I think what he's really great at. Sting takes some Brazilian music, and he takes what he does and he puts those two things together and creates this kind of other thing. And he's done it with reggae, and he's done it with ska, and he's done it with pop, and he's done it with all of these different kinds of idioms of music. And it's all him. You know what I mean? It's not like, oh, that's him trying to do this. No, that's him ingesting this. And using his thing and coming out with something that's almost like yet another thing.
Now, how did he know about you at that point? Did he heard you with Miles?
Branford Marcellus who he met, at some point after he decided, I guess he was leaving the police. And he said, listen, I'm going to put a band together, but I'm not going to play bass. I don't want to be encumbered by that. So I'm going to sing and play some guitar. And Branford and I had just recorded Decoy with Miles. And also Branford was around. Branford and Winter were around when I first played with Miles. Those first 10 or 12 gigs, probably half a dozen gigs we did together. Him with Herbie Hancock and VSOP and me with Miles. And so we kind of got to be friends during that period, hanging out in New York when we weren't on tour. And recording this Decoy record with Miles. So we were hanging out. And I guess, he liked the way I played and told Sting, hey man, if you're not gonna play bass, we should get Daryl.
But were you coming to that, did you come to that Sting album with Sting's bass playing in mind? Trying to get a vibe of what he would have done?
No, well, I mean, he had written the songs. So the bass lines that he had written were therein. You know, he would come to me when I learned the song, I learned his bass line. I remember Set Them Free and learning his bass line and him saying to me, it's not written in stone, man. You don't have to play that. And I would kind of, yeah, man, but it's working. So I'm not going to change it just to change it. If what you wrote is working, then there's no need to change it. Now, I did change the way I played that song. I used my thumb and did some slapping on it and stuff, but it was a great bass line. And so it was more... His influence was more from the writing side. He writes great bass lines, man. I mean,
he writes. He's a fantastically reductive bass player in that he writes really, really great lines that are the absolute essence.
Absolutely.
I always remember even in the early days of the Police, there was a thing with Sting where he wrote these lines. Anyone could play them, but you're thinking you can tell this guy can really, really play.
Real functional. And sometimes, some of that reggae stuff was some of the stuff is pretty, pretty cool, man. So and again, he really did give me space to kind of do what I wanted to do. But, in a number of occasions, man, it was like, I'm not changing that. That bass line is working.
But now I guess you're getting a reputation in pop music too, as a player that can diversify, if you like, and you get a call from Madonna.
Yeah, that was a few years later. It's kind of interesting because I was kind of looking to do something else. I was like, I would really like to have a, because I didn't really think about Sting as a pop artist. I thought about him more as like a rock guy who, a more broad, kind of rock guy, bigger palette.
Intellectual.
Yeah. So Madonna was my move into the real pop world,
Well, we have that in common because I played with Madonna as well.
Oh, yeah, right. No, when did you play with her?
It was after you. I think, I did the Like a Prayer album and the Breathless. I did the song Like a Prayer. And
So that was right before me because I actually...
Oh, was it?
I auditioned on playing Like a Prayer.
Oh my God! No. So hang on. This is a you auditioned with Guy Pratt's bass line.
Dig that! Who knew that?
Yay!
Yeah, no, and it's funny because that bass line was really I dug that. But
the middle section is one of the proudest things in my life.
That's great. But even the beginning bass line is pretty nasty too, man.
Yeah, Pat wrote that. Pat Leonard wrote that.
Yeah.
Middle bit's all mine.
Okay, that's enough. You've had your moment in the sun.
Yeah.
But Darren, what was it like being on the road with her? Because that's an amazing setup, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although saying that, nothing is like the Stones. But
yeah, no. It was great.
But it's kind of like being in a musical or something, isn't it? A bit.
A little bit more because, she had like, a dozen dancers.
Yeah.
And who had also never been on the road. So that was, kind of comical. But they were all really sweet guys. And it was a great band, man. They're, Luis Conte was in that band, percussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Jonathan Moffitt, who...
Oh, Sugarfoot. Sugarfoot, yes.
Show drummers, walking around. David Williams, the late, great David Williams on guitar.
He was my buddy, yeah.
Yeah, man. We're a great cat. And Kevin Kendrick and Jay Wendin.
Yeah.
And Nikki Harris and, oh my God, I'm spacing on the...
Oh, and what's her name on the BVs? I played on her album.
Also, very.
We'll edit it in, so it sounds like we both knew.
Yeah.
Were you in the dock? Was that the Truth or Dare tour?
Yeah, I was on the Blind Ambition tour.
All right.
Yeah. But it was great, man. It was incredible watching her put the show together and just all of these elements that she was juggling and looking at. You know, she would go, you know, videotape the whole show, and then she would go back and talk to the lighting guy, and then go back and talk to, you know, with the, you know, the stage guys who, you know, this should be moving here. I was surprised that she was that hands on.
Oh no, it's amazing because recording with her, we'd have the whole band, she'd do a guide vocal as we were playing the song down for the first time. She would then have notes for everyone. Yeah. She'd done a vocal and clocked everything everyone was doing. She was amazing like that.
Yeah, she's
you know, like the way you know, I mentioned earlier about you being up close and watching Miles play and then playing with him and moving with him. We use that word weaving, which I know is a Keith word. Mm. But could you feed back off of Madonna's dancing? Was that something that
worked for you? There's a couple of little spots, man, on the show where I forgot what song it was, but there was one thing. I was kind of up on a platform and David was on another platform, and then Luis and Jonathan were in like middle of the back end of the stage, and then there were two more, you know, kind of little platforms. So at one point these guys were doing this part of the choreography where they did this walk across the stage, and they did this kind of, you know, little bump thing and then walk back. And I was in rehearsal. I was thinking to myself, I could do that dad stuff. So I just stepped down off my little perch and did the thing with them, and then came back and then back up onto my perch. And she didn't say don't do it, so I kept doing it. But just that kind of stuff, just interacting in that way was something that was, that was really great, man. But
I meant sort of letting her as a kind of a conductor of what you play and how you feel. The energy coming off of her, I guess, would help your playing.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. Listening in a really active way and using your, you know, your vision to help you listen more and to help you feel what is it that this artist is trying to do right now and how can I support them and how can I help them do that. So that's par for the course with everyone that I play with.
Yeah, but that's like you just described sort of the perfect bass player, really. Was it from there back to Miles, or was it no?
No, actually,
no. You finished. Because that would be a funny headspace one.
Yeah, it was Miles Stang, and then back to Miles, and then I played with Herbie Hancock, and then I played with Peter Gabriel, and then I played again another summer with Herbie Hancock, and then Madonna, and. And after that, the next big thing has been the Stones.
But I guess we should talk about you becoming a Rolling Stone. Although as Mick actually ever officially, you're not officially in the band, even though you've been playing with them for 30 years.
Well,
it took Ronnie about 20 years, I think, to be.
No, it took him longer than that.
25, yeah, I think it was 25 years or something like that. But I play the bass the best that I can every night with those guys. I can't imagine that if I'm in the band, I play any better. So the rest of it is kind of for them to, you know,
that's how I feel with Pink Floyd. It's just like, it's just the association is fine. Fine.
Yeah. Who else
was on the shortlist? Do you know who you're up against?
I do know that Hutch Hutchinson auditioned. Daryl Johnson from the Neville Brothers auditioned. Joey Spampinato from NRBQ auditioned.
All right.
All of whom could have easily gotten the gig. I think they're all great, great players. And a number of other guys. There's a number of other guys.
But it's funny how it's all kind of super hot muso guy. It's all
not rock and roll guys.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were a number of them too, but I don't know. There were names that I probably am not. Wasn't as familiar with, but
yeah,
I'm
sure
they, you know, they auditioned, I think.
What was the call?
That was another weird one, man, because somebody called me, a friend of mine, Sandy Toronto, called me and said, hey, man, Bill Wyman's leaving the Stones. And we were like, Bill Wyman's been talking about leaving the Stones for you. He says, no, man, I think he's really going this time. And he said, well, should I get a number for you? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And he gets a number. I call the number and I say, hey, I heard that Bill Wyman is leaving. I'm a bass player. There's a list. I'd love to get on it. And they said, okay.
Oh, so you were proactive then.
I did make that call. And a few months later, I get a call back and they said, well, listen, there looks like there are going to be some auditions in New York. They would like to fly you out and have you audition. And I later talked to Pierre de Beauport, who is the guy, the tall guy you see handing
the
guitars. He told me that, he says, well, you remember when you did the movie with Stang, you met Mick. And I said, yeah, I do remember that. As a matter of fact, Mick had mentioned that when I went into audition. He said, remember we met, when you were playing with Sting? And I said, yeah, of course. And I went in, auditioned, and played through a bunch of,
what were the songs?
Stuff like that.
Were they all there? Because this is the famous thing, isn't it?
With Stones. No.
Is that people go to do things with the Stones and kind of Charlie's there and
doesn't show up for
a couple of days.
No. They were all there. Mick said to me when I walked in, he said, listen, Daryl, if you don't know the songs, we'll teach you the songs and then we'll have the audition. It was very informal, wow. Very kind of, loose and very just very mellow. They were very cool, very nice. And
I guess from Otis Clay, you'd done your homework this time.
I had done my homework as much as you can, because of course I'd gone out and bought.
Your mum wasn't outside.
No, I mean, exactly. But she's still in my head,
yeah.
But I'd gone out and bought a bunch of best of records, trying to cover all the hits and all the most popular songs. And after putting on two or three discs, it's like, there's no way I'm going to learn all of this. Mm-hmm. So I just decided, well, man, just go in and play the best you can. And then I got a call from in the camp, a guy named Tony Russell, who's been taking care of Keith's assistant for many, many years now.
It's Percy.
He called and said, listen, you're going to play, Brown Sugar, Tumbling Dice, Miss You, so forget all that other stuff and, just work on that. So I did for the night before audition, I did, work on those things a little bit, kind of got familiar with those songs. And those are the songs that I ended up auditioning on.
I mean, in the documentary, Keith talks so beautifully about you and how much he loves you. And so does Mick. But the person you needed to impress the most in a way was Charlie, wasn't it? Because you were going to be the rhythm engine.
Well, it's interesting because that's just, as a bass player, that's kind of the first order of business for me. And hopefully it doesn't take a long time to establish that connection with the drummer. Sometimes just a few, just a few bars. Yeah. And you can realize, he feels this way and that works with with what I do. And so that was, my approach to whomever I played with. But I will say that I didn't go into the audition saying to myself, play to Keith, it wasn't like, I just thought if I can rock with Charlie, then that's a good start. That's a good start. That's at least, that establishes that I know how to work in the engine room, as Keith said. Mm-hmm. And I said, after that happens, then I can start to let other people in and start to pay more attention. So playing with Charlie and playing well with him was for me the first order of business. So that was the first thing that I did.
And what did you get a sense from Charlie that kind of that it was happening?
It's interesting because we played, I started trying to get a sound. I was playing Lick and Stick from James Brown. And I was just getting a sound. Before I knew it, Charlie started playing and Keith started, and we were jamming on Lick and Stick, James Brown's Lick and Stick. And that felt cool. But then we played the first tune. I don't remember what it was, Brown Sugar or one of those tunes. And after we played the song, Charlie stood up and kind of started to pace a little bit. And I remember thinking to myself, either that's a good thing or it's a bad thing.
But it's definitely a thing.
Yeah, something. It felt like, when I looked at him, I was like, something happened. Something just happened, and I think, maybe and I remember thinking, leaving there, thinking to myself, it felt good to me. It really did feel good to me. And if it felt as good to them as it did to me, then I'll probably hear back. And I did, and I went back a few months later and auditioned and played again through the stuff that they had written for the Voodoo Lounge record, those songs.
All right.
And it was after that that they said that they'd like me to come on and record.
And that first gig must have been, obviously, they don't play small gigs. That must have been a big deal for you.
Well,
being accepted by the by the by the band, learning how they move around on stage and present themselves.
Yeah, that was great. Well, we did a club date. That's back in the day where they would do a club date to prepare for the tour.
We used to love it when they did those. Seen a couple of those.
And we played a little club called RPM, which is no longer under that name, in Toronto, where we'd been rehearsing. And so I just remember it being, it was really loud because, of course, we've been rehearsing in this huge school, you know, gymnasium. And suddenly we are in this little club. And I'm sure Keith didn't turn down a bit. So it was really loud. But it was also, it was great to, because, you know, you guys know, you're performers, you know, you can rehearse and rehearse and rehearse until you add that element of an audience. You don't know exactly where you sit. Mm-hmm. And everybody plays different in front of an audience, you know?
Of course it's just different. Yeah.
You know, and so seeing that first glimpse of like, oh, that's what the circus is like when the circus really comes to town. And so it was really great. And then the first gig at RFK Stadium in DC was
oh, right, yeah. Cause, yeah, because there's a whole other gear you wouldn't have seen in rehearsal, yes, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly,
because you know, the Stones are sort of famous, and it's part of their magic, you know, of never being the same twice. You know, that some nights it really works, and some nights it's a little bit rattly. You know, it moves around. The groove is in their mood.
I think it's inherent in the way they play rock and roll, which, you know, kind of takes us back to the blues thing. You don't hear, you know, Muddy Waters sing "I'm a Man" the same way every night. I think that's part of the charm of the Stones, is that we're walking this edge. And if you want to have the kind of band that sounds great every night and everybody plays the same every night, that's beautiful, but that's a different thing. And in my opinion, rock and roll, it has to have that element of, this could fall apart, or, you know, or it, sometimes it almost does, and it creates a certain kind of excitement in the music. And I'm convinced that that's part of what the audience, you know, digs. I mean, interesting things happen on stage. I think the audience actually goes, "Man, were you at the gig where Keith started me up in the wrong key?" You know, I mean, I think it creates a certain kind of excitement, you know. And it, you know, rock and roll's got to be a little bit devil may care.
Yeah. Keith is the ultimate personification of that, isn't he?
Absolutely. So, you know, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I saw a TikTok clip the other day of him just playing Honky Tonk Women. And he's playing the riff in a way that I've never, ever heard it before. And it's beautiful.
Yeah.
He probably doesn't even really know what he's doing. And he's gone into a real triplet thing with it. And it's gorgeous, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But is he your Miles or is Mick?
Neither one of them. It's a little bit different.
Who are you keeping an eye on during the show?
What do you look at the most? All of them. And my monitor mix is a mess because I refuse to look back on this gig and have people, you know, because Ronnie's on the other side of the stage, have somebody say, "Well, what was it like playing with Ronnie for 30 years? Well, I don't know. I didn't really hear him." So he's loud. He's loud on my side because I want to be able to really interact with him. I need to be able to interact with him.
And of course, he's got his whole thing going on with Keith as well, isn't he?
Exactly. You know, and so Keith definitely is standing right next to me. But Charlie, you know, I mean, when you said what you said about that, who's your Miles? I thought first of Charlie, you know. It's ensemble playing to me. It's like really letting all of that in. You know, it's if I'm locked with Charlie and I'm looking at Mick dance and he seems like he wants to, you know, he wants some more energy, then I'm dealing with that. If Ronnie's taking a solo and he's trying to stretch out more, then I'm dealing with that. If Keith finds some interesting thing that he hasn't played before, and he's, you know, and he's working that out, then I'm dealing with him. It's like whoever is, and at the same time, got to be listening to the drummer, got to be listening to what's happening with the background in case I have to sing something. So it's just, it's really having my antenna out for everybody around, you know. Yeah.
And our good friend Matt, who we know, who plays keys.
Exactly. You know, he's dropping in some string part, or the saxophone player is playing, you know, Barry Sachs, and playing a part that Bobby Keys played that's a bass line. So I'm locking with him on that. So it's just like, you know, whatever's happening, I'm trying to take it in and use it to inform what I play.
Because I've noticed there's a couple of times where you get to really cut loose, because no matter how wonderful this is, you have this technical facility, which is so way above anything that would be required on this.
You know what, man, though?
Is there ever an itch that needs to be scratched there?
Well, you know, it's interesting, man, because I always feel like play for the song. Whatever's best for the song.
Of course.
And if you're playing some jazz fusion and what's best for the song is ripping some fast stuff, then I want to do that. But if it's not called for, then I don't really want to do that. And me, you know, a friend of mine, you know, we have these sayings about what's in rock and roll and what's not in rock and roll. And like a chorus pedal. There's no chorus pedal in rock and roll. And there's no drum solos in rock and roll. And there's no bass solos in rock and roll. So, I get this kind of feature. And in a way, I don't really play a bass solo because I'm still trying to play the bass line.
Yeah.
And
for Miss You, yeah.
And kind of be featured a little bit. So it's kind of back and forth, you know, it's kind of back and forth. A bass solo is like, okay, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to worry about playing the bass. I'm just going to take a ride.
Yeah, you know?
And so I feel like, okay, I'm going to do this feature now, but really, there's no bass solos in rock and roll.
Do you know the problem with bass solos is, what kills bass solos for me anyway, is that the bass has stopped.
That's my point.
That's why they suck, because there's no bass.
I literally heard Marcus Miller say that a while back. He was saying, you know, the thing about a bass solo is, you kind of got to play the bass part and take a solo at the same time. Because if you don't, you lose this big element that is kind of helping hold the music together. So that's really what I'm doing on the feature on Miss You. I'm trying to play the bass.
What's interesting about you and what comes out in the documentary as well is your love of song and how you're approaching your own soul band, really, that you're getting together, which is elements of soul and blues.
Oh, great.
How's that album going?
You know, some of that stuff I wrote years and years ago is just putting it in a band's hands and starting to flesh it out, which, again, I haven't done because, you know, there was a couple of years there where nobody left their house. So. Yeah. I'm just kind of putting that back together and probably be next spring before I'm able to really, you know, get back to it. But I'm excited about that too, man. It's a different seat. It's a seat that I haven't sat in much. I haven't sang a lot as a front man. And, you know, as you know, playing bass and singing is tough. And lyric writing, which is another thing that I'm really excited about, and have a real love for, you know, people who can do that well. You know, Sting is chief among them. You know, so yeah, I'm excited about that, man, and I just want to do more. And
good. Well, listen, we don't want the Stones to stop either. No. So somehow fit it all in, Darryl.
That's the.
I'm hoping the Stones are making a new album at some point soon.
I mean, there are some rumblings. I mean, we've recorded a lot of stuff over the last, you know, five, six years. So
Charlie's going to be on there too. Yeah.
Hopefully, there's going to be some new music soon. I'm hoping so.
Is your band going to tour, Darryl?
Eventually. Yeah, no, absolutely, man. You know, when I can, you know, find the right guys and, you know, put them together in a room long enough to really create a sound, then it won't be the Darryl Jones project. It'll be a band.
Darryl, we're going to be in LA on Sunday. We're playing on Sunday night. You don't have to say yes to this. You can cut this bit out of the podcast.
Yeah, man, where are you guys playing?
We're at the Orpheum.
At the Orpheum?
Yeah.
Oh, man, please, I'd love to come. I'd love to come.
Oh, man, we would love that.
Yeah,
I would love that.
Yeah,
I mean, it's early Pink Floyd. It's the kind of mad, psychedelic, whimsy.
Oh, dude, okay.
And
okay.
Some nice space rock in there and stuff. It's, you know, from when Pink Floyd were a pop group. Proper prog rock band.
Yeah, right.
Before Dark Side.
We'd love to see Echoes.
Oh, man, absolutely. I would miss it, yeah.
We'll sign off now, and then we can maybe we can grab your email or something.
Yeah. Man, I just have to say, I love the podcast. I listened to the conversation you guys have with Thomas Dolby. Amazing conversation, man. You guys go back. You guys, you know, seem to, you know, the London scene, you guys seem to. But I love that. I really love listening to that, man. I was a big fan of that Flat Earth record, man. I think that's some incredible music, man.
Thanks, Darren.
That's great, Darren. Thank you so much, man. That warms the cockles.
Yeah, I really dig what you guys are doing, man.
Well, thank you for coming on. Good luck with the film. Good luck with the new project, your own solo album, and long live the Stones.
Man, thank you guys so much, man.
Really cheers. Thank you so much, man. It's been an absolute delight.
Oh, another great conversation. I'm loving doing the Rock On Tour.
I love doing the Rock On Tour. I love it. What's great is that's basically kind of all the stuff I would have wanted to say to him backstage. Would just be annoyed about boring him. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course, you get the chance.
Yeah.
But a really warm person, really lovely person.
Lovely, lovely
he
guy.
He lives
yeah.
in that Rolling Stones world. I mean, that's some huge city that they create, isn't it? When they go on the road. It's not just a band traveling, is it? It's a country traveling.
It's a campaign, isn't it? Basically.
It's a campaign. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think we have another one before we go home. I don't know.
There might be one more. I think there's one more. I'm not sure.
If not, there might have to be a break while we unpack our bags just for a week or something.
Yeah, and kind of a debrief.
Debrief, whatever you call it. Yeah, yeah. Don't get the bends, will you? As you rise back into your ordinary civilian life.
Unless we can get Tom York on.
All right, so thank you to Ian today, who was our producer.
Yes, thanks,
Ben,
Ian.
Obviously, at Gimme Sugar. And everyone else who supports us out there and makes us number one every week, which we're so proud of. We check it out, don't we, with such...
We do.
You know, with such humility and warmth towards our listeners. Thank you so much.
It's true. We love you all. So it's good night from me.
It's good night from them.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.